Hello everyone, welcome to the Philosophy Exchange podcast. Today I am with Cedar, another Philosophy Exchange member, and we were going to interview Nick Mackens, a student. Well, actually he's going to send his PhD dissertation in a few weeks, but he's still a PhD student at the LSE in the Philosophy Department. And so welcome, Nick.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Nick, for coming. And we were going to interview him about his recent publication, a paper of the title Attitudinal Ambivalence, Moral Uncertainty for Non-Cognitivists. So we are talking about moral philosophy, but not only that. So we are talking about the nature of moral judgment and how to define moral doubt. So Nick, why don't you tell us something about how you arrived to the topic and more or less the background of the discussion where your article plays itself.
Okay, so there's a bit of a long personal backstory to this paper because it came up from two different sort of lines of thought I was having. So a few years ago, I was thinking or trying to think in particular about a set of problems in population ethics. So this is the part of ethics that deals with choices that will affect the number of people who exist and who they are in the future. And I was trying to think of something to say about population ethics and what I thought about it, and I just got totally stuck. I had this really unhappy time where I just, every theory, everything anybody said about population ethics just seemed to be wrong, but I couldn't find anything that was right. So for a while, I tried to persevere and to come up with something of my own to say. And after a while, I just thought, actually, I'm completely stuck and I'm completely uncertain about these things, but we have to make choices that depend on these sorts of judgments all the time. So I started thinking about, well, how should we approach choices when uncertain about our moral judgments? This led me into a sort of a now growing body of literature on moral uncertainty. But at the same time, this kind of other line of thought was going on in the background as I became a bit more interested in meta-ethics. So questions about what our moral judgments are actually like. And I became drawn towards a particular view within meta-ethics, which says that there are no objectively true moral facts, but that doesn't mean that all of our moral judgments are false because they're just not trying to represent facts in the first place. Instead, our moral judgments are more like our own valuing attitudes, and our moral statements express these sort of valuing attitudes, these attitudes that are more like desires than beliefs. But on that view, this view that our moral judgments are more like desires than beliefs, it was unclear how to make sense of this other thing I'd been thinking about in terms of moral uncertainty. And most of the literature I'd read about moral uncertainty was treating it in the same way as we might treat uncertainty about, you know, the weather or other sort of simple states of affairs. But if we were to be non-cognitivists about moral judgments, then it's just not clear how to make sense of this kind of uncertainty. So that's how I got to this topic where I've been trying to bring together these two sort of different things, moral uncertainty or moral doubt on the one hand, and non-cognitivism on the other.
Hi there. So my name is Cedar. Glad to be part of this discussion. Nick, so your paper is called Attitudinal Ambivalence, Moral Uncertainty for Non-Cognitivists. I was wondering if you could go a little bit into the differences between cognitivism and non-cognitivism, just so that everybody who's listening to this podcast could understand what the debate here is.
Yeah, great question. So there are a few different ways of characterizing non-cognitivism, but the way I do it in the paper in particular, I think can make things reasonably clear. That's my hope anyway. So I say that non-cognitivism is the conjunction of three claims. So the first is that there are no objective moral facts. So this is just a sort of an anti-realism about morality. The second is that our moral statements don't have a truth value. So they're not the kind of thing that can be true or false. And that's because of the third feature, which is that our moral statements express something like a desire rather than something like a belief. So when I say something like lying is wrong, I'm not trying to represent some feature of the world in the way that I am when I say something like it's raining outside. Instead, what I'm trying to do is express my disapproval about lying or express my desire for there not to be lying and for there to be more truth-telling or some other sort of attitude that is more evaluative or desire-like than my beliefs.
This is very interesting. So if I remember correctly, in the article, you're presenting an argument that you want to reject, to conclude. So if you want, you can just run through the argument and explain to us what is the specific point that you're attacking, and then I think we can just go directly to discuss about ambivalence.
Okay. So as I suggested earlier, the way I'd been thinking about, and the way a lot of people seem to be thinking about uncertainty, moral uncertainty or moral doubt, treats it like uncertainty about other matters of fact. But if non-cognitivism says that our moral judgments aren't beliefs and aren't like beliefs in these other matters of fact, then it's not clear how we should understand this phenomenon of moral uncertainty. I mean, the phenomenon seems to be real, right? We've all had that deep kind of uncertainty in our moral judgments. But if we think that our moral judgments are more like desires than beliefs, it's not clear how we should understand them. And in fact, once I started thinking about this, I learned that this is around and people are familiar with a sort of clear argument against non-cognitivism. So the argument is that our moral judgments seem to have a few different structural features. Well, they have three different structural features. This is the claim. So one of those structural features is the strength of the attitude or of the judgment. So that is how good or bad something is, how right or wrong we judge it to be. The second feature is something like our certitude. So this is how confident we are that our judgment is the right one to make. And then the last feature is robustness. So this is just how sensitive our judgment is to new information, or as we reflect on things, how much it might change. So we've got these three structural features, but desires don't seem to have three structural features. They just have, our desires just vary in strength. Well, this is the claim, that we can have a stronger desire or a weaker desire, but there isn't something that can capture all three of these dimensions. So moral judgments seem to have three structural features. Desires only seem to have one structural feature, or that can vary through time, so we get two. So that means that our moral judgments can't be desire-like attitudes, because they just have the wrong structure. And that's the argument that I sort of wanted to respond to, because I think there are some ways that you can make sense of moral judgments that do capture this richer structure.
Cool, that's really cool. And the point of your argument is to say, well, but we have to consider desires not in a just one dimension. Desires can be conflicting with each other. And so I can have a desire for something and a desire for something else. And the consequences of the two actions which the desires lead can be different, can be also mutually exclusive. The idea, if I understood correctly, is to use this conflict of desires to explain the level of what you call certitude, so how much we are convinced that that action is the right action or the wrong action. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. I mean, perhaps one way of putting it is rather than trying to capture certitude, trying to kind of capture the phenomenon of moral doubt, because that's the thing that we really feel, and that's the thing that we need to be able to explain. And the cognitivists have a nice, simple story to tell about moral doubt. It's just we have partial beliefs. So in the way that I can think that it's 50% likely that a coin will land heads and 50% that it'll land tails, those are my beliefs. The cognitivist can accommodate uncertainty in our moral judgments along similar lines. So I can think that it's 50% likely that it's right to lie and 50% likely that it's wrong to lie. The non-cognitivist doesn't have those sorts of resources. So I was trying to capture it instead with this idea that when our moral judgments conflict, when we make a moral judgment that makes us want one thing and another moral judgment that makes us want another, and these two things are mutually inconsistent, then we get this kind of doubt.
I find this very interesting. So basically, if I understand correctly, what Nick's doing in the paper is that, or what you're doing in the paper, Nick, is that you're basically saying that, you know, the cognitivists claim that there are these three structural features of moral judgments, and they have an explanation for how all of those structural features are present. And then you're basically saying that we can explain all three of these structural features just using slightly different things. So instead of uncertainty, we're going to have ambivalence.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So on the non-cognitivist picture, moral doubt is captured by ambivalence or this conflict in your desire-like attitudes. And on the cognitivist picture, moral doubt is captured by uncertainty in terms of degrees of belief, in the same way that you can be uncertain about the weather or anything else.
So Nick, to make these discussion a little more concrete, could you talk about your ideas using a concrete example? I know in the paper that you wrote, you talk about an example from Sartre. Could you explain that one?
Yeah, so this is a famous example from Sartre of a classic moral dilemma. And I think it's one in which sort of the story I tell about moral doubt as ambivalence gives at least as good an account as the cognitivist version of moral doubt in terms of uncertainty. So in this example, Sacha tells the reader about a student of his who comes seeking advice. This is during the Second World War. And this student is wondering whether to go and join the Free French Forces to fight against the Nazis or to stay at home and look after his mother. His brother has already gone to war and been killed. So in a sense, he wants to avenge his brother. But at the same time, he feels a really strong duty to stay at home and look after his mother, who has no family left at home. So he's uncertain about what to do. He's torn. He's conflicted. He really doesn't know what the right thing is for him to do. So this, I think, is a great example of the moral doubt that I'm trying to give an account of. And the cognitivist can explain this in terms of the student's partial degrees of belief in two different propositions. So he thinks that one of the following propositions is true. Either the proposition that he ought to stay at home with his mother is true, or he thinks that the proposition he ought to go to war is true. But he doesn't know which. But on my account, we can explain this moral doubt that he finds himself in another way, not by saying that he believes one of these is true, but that he has really strong but conflicting evaluative attitudes towards the two options. So on the one hand, he desires to go and fight the Nazis. He feels duty-bound to avenge his brother and fight for freedom. But on the other hand, he has this really strong pull towards his filial duty to stay at home and look after his mother. And so on my account, the doubt arises from conflicting, desire-like evaluative attitudes, rather than partial degrees of belief in the way that one might hold partial degrees of belief in really, you know, mundane, everyday things that aren't these kind of strong, important, deep, emotional, moral commitments that we have.
This is very, convincing, because also in your article, then you briefly mentioned that classic moral dilemma, like also the trolley dilemma or the classic problems that we discuss normally in moral philosophy classes, they can be described in terms of ambivalence, so in terms of conflicting desires, instead of try to, in a certain sense, translate them in cognitivist terms. I was wondering how much empirical knowledge is in this statement that you're making. And this is connected also to another question that I wanted to ask you about the importance or the relevance of social psychology work that you actually explicitly mentioned in your paper. And I was really fascinated by the fact that a normative field like moral philosophy can be informed by the work of a descriptive research field like social psychology. So tell us about a little bit more about this nice synergy between normative and descriptive.
One of the funny things that happens in the moral psychology literature is that philosophers make lots of claims about the way in which our moral judgments are. And they speak with great authority as though it's clear that our moral judgments are all alike, and that from sitting in an armchair and introspecting on one's own moral judgments, a philosopher can come to some broad conclusions about the way moral judgments are in general. And I'm always suspicious of that kind of move. And so when I was thinking about this problem and thought that perhaps an account of moral doubt could be given in terms of conflicting attitudes, or thinking about this claim that was made that moral attitudes only have two structural features, I thought, well, perhaps I shouldn't just do this by sitting here and thinking about my own attitudes, but some people have probably studied it. Like, some people have probably gone out into the world and devised some experimental techniques to look at what people's attitudes are actually like. The place I turned to, as you mentioned, Lorenzo, was social psychology, which is involved in the study of all sorts of attitudes. And in social psychology, it's really quite clear that there are not just two dimensions to our attitudes, but that there are lots. And one really important one is this dimension of ambivalence, or the degree to which our attitudes conflict with one another. So although this was something that I had an intuitive grasp of already, I found it really helpful to turn to this empirical literature, both to reassure me that I wasn't just making this up based on my own experience, but that there was actually some good empirical grounds for thinking that there were these multiple dimensions to our desire-like attitudes. But also just for giving a richer story about exactly how that works and what these different dimensions are like. Lots of examples of where we find these kinds of dimensions varying and how they interact to influence our behavior and our choices. And reading into this empirical literature and social psychology was really helpful just to sort of clarify those sorts of things in the paper.
I also found your analysis of ambivalence to be really interesting. In the paper, you say that an agent's ambivalence or an agent's degree of ambivalence is determined by the balance and the weight of their reasons. Could you maybe go into that a little bit and explain to the listeners how you analyzed ambivalence?
Okay. So as you suggested, I cash out this idea of ambivalence in terms of our practical reasons. So I say in the paper that an agent is ambivalent if they have reason for some option A, reason for some option B, but A and B are mutually exclusive. So A and B could be turning left and turning right. Okay. But not only do we get just this definition of ambivalence in these terms, once we rely on reasons, we can characterize ambivalence as varying by degree. And this sort of makes intuitive sense that if one's reasons are very closely balanced, then one is going to be more ambivalent than if one set of reasons for an option decisively outweighs another set. And not only will one be more ambivalent, but also more troubled by this kind of practical doubt, not knowing what to do. If your reasons are really closely matched, then it's hard to know what you ought to do. But also someone it seems to make sense to consider somebody more ambivalent if their reasons are stronger in the first place. So if somebody has very closely matched reasons, but they concern something that they just don't really care about, the reasons are really weak in the first place, then you wouldn't expect them to feel much practical doubt because they basically just don't really care. They'll go either way and it doesn't matter. And so I think when both of these features, how closely balanced one's reasons are and how strong one's reasons are overall, combined to give you a measure of the degree to which someone is ambivalent, which sort of matches how much practical doubt they face. Or if the sorts of reasons we're talking about are those that stem from our moral judgments, then how much moral doubt they face in particular.
We can distinguish between a choice under a high degree of ambivalence, such as that faced by such a student, and one with a lesser degree of ambivalence, such as choosing whether to have pizza or pasta for dinner. So the difference here is the strength of reasons. Such student seems more ambivalent because he has stronger reasons at play. We could also distinguish such a student from another case in which there are strong reasons at play, but one option is clearly favored over another. So let's say his options were either to go to war and fight the Nazis or just go on a holiday. Then he'd be less ambivalent because although there are strong reasons at stake, one set of reasons decisively outweighs the other. So we get this degree of ambivalence from both how closely balanced one's reasons are and how strong they are overall.
So if I was a Sartre student, I would want to know how to resolve my ambivalence about whether to go to war or to stay with my mother. And if I was a cognitivist, I would appeal to moral facts and try to get clear on which one of those two choices seems more true. But if I'm a non-cognitivist, then I would have to find some other way that doesn't appeal to moral facts to resolve my ambivalence. And that seems like a really hard problem. So that does seem like something that further research ought to be done in.
I think it's a really hard problem, but almost the point you've got to there is a new perspective which can break that deadlock a bit. I mean, if you're facing a choice and you think that there ultimately is some fact of the matter about what's right, but you don't know what it is, then it can be incredibly hard to make a choice because you'd better keep deliberating until you know what the right answer is. Like it would be the wrong thing for you to do to make a choice until you really know what's right. Whereas if you come to the realization, as I have, that perhaps there's no fact of the matter here, that you're just feeling the pull of two different deep commitments that you hold, and there is no fact of the matter about what you ought to do, all things considered, then that can, in some sense, free you from this position of feeling as though I've got to figure out what's definitely right before I can do anything. Because you realize that you're never going to figure out what's ultimately right because there is no fact of the matter. Your doubt doesn't come because there's some fact out there that you don't have access to, but rather because you're committed to moral principles in such a way that there is no course of action available to you that will satisfy all of your commitments. In a sense, that's a problem because, I haven't said, well, therefore, Sartre's student should X. But in another sense, it kind of frees him. I mean, this is Sartre's point, right? That this is the existentialist idea that ultimately he's free to choose. He shouldn't look for the right answer, but he should realize that ultimately he is completely free to decide what to do.
I was thinking that the way in which Nick is putting the question now, it seems like to rephrase the problem in from saying you have to find the true answer to find your answer to the problem. So I have the impression that this non-cognitivist account would push us towards an introspective kind of strategy to solve the moral dilemma. So instead of looking at the world and trying to find the objective rightness or wrongness in actions, I look into myself and ask myself, what are the reasons that are motivating this desire? What are the reasons that are motivating the other desire? And then I could understand something more about myself something more about what I value or not. And then maybe at the end, I could solve the dilemma or not. But it depends on me and how I value the different actions. I like, actually, this idea. It is not necessarily completely subjective. So I think that we can share as a society or as part of a specific community some common values, some common ways to look at things. We can discuss about things and convince with persuasion about the importance of something instead of something else. But in general, I think it's a really rich field of inquiry that a philosopher could investigate.
So as a concluding question, I'd just like to ask you, Nick, what further research do you think should be done in this area?
Yeah, so I think ambivalence isn't something that's special to our moral judgments. We have ambivalence in all sorts of other attitudes. And because of that, there's a literature that I think is related to the work we've spoken about today, which is on choices that are often called hard choices. So these are those in which one option seems better than another in some ways, the other seems better than the first in some ways, but neither seems better overall. So there's work on this from people like Ruth Chang, John Broome, Joseph Raz. And I think one of the something that's perhaps underexplored in those choices, so that discussion often focuses on the ways in which it can be the case that neither option is better than the other. So that is something about the way the reasons are balanced against each other. But we were talking earlier on when talking about degrees of ambivalence about these two things, that there's the balance of reasons, how closely balanced they are, but also their overall weight. And I think the weight of reasons is something that's not been studied a great deal in philosophy, in particular in the context of these kind of hard choices, where it's not clear which option is better than another. And I think in order to give a proper sort of full explanation of those kinds of choices and the role they play in our practical deliberation, we might need to pay some more attention to the weight of reasons and characterize exactly what that means, how it works, and how it affects our choices. So that's something I think I'd like to do some more research on, but I also think there's plenty of scope and space in there for other people to do lots of work too.
Thank you, Nick. I cannot thank you enough for the time that you devoted to us for this really fascinating conversation about moral philosophy, ambivalence, moral doubts, cognitivist against non-cognitivist. It surely opened the world to me that I'm completely ignorant on the topic, and I hope that it did the same for also the people listening to us. I thank you, Peter, for joining me in the conversation with Nick, with your questions and your remarks. Now I will conclude the podcast. I just invite who is listening to visit our webpage, philosophyexchange.org, where you can find the other episodes of the podcast. And at the same time, there is a call for a postgraduate conference that will take place in October, at the end of October, at the LSE, hopefully in person. Thank you for listening to us, and thank you guys, and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thanks very much for having me. It's been really fun.